Hey there, folks. Welcome to the edition of Stranger in a Southern Land. I, of course, am your host, Jake Manning. Today in the program, I speak with Dr. Tom Hatchett, who is voted one of the top charlatilians of 2015 because of his contributions to the Levine Museum of the New South. You know, some people call Tom the Charlotte's doctor of history. And after the knowledge that he dropped in this podcast, I see why. We had a wonderful conversation, and just I'm very proud to be living in a city that's come from such a rich history that Tom has researched for quite some time. And, you know, Tom's a transplant like most everybody else. So if you live in Charlotte, you know, there's no excuse. You should learn the history of this great city of Charlotte, North Carolina. And if you don't live in Charlotte, this you could still pull a lot from this podcast. We talk about a lot about how wrestling and how that affected the history of this city. And also, too, you know, how history can form the future of a city, you know, and sometimes history isn't something that happened decades ago. Sometimes it's something that happened 5 years ago or 5 minutes ago, in fact. So this is just a wonderful podcast all around. So let's get educated. Let's have a wonderful conversation with Tom. But before we get there, I want to educate you guys on some dates that are coming up in the next month for me. So I got a lot of stuff, a lot of wide variety of stuff that I want to buzz you guys on so you can come out to these shows and support these venues and support me and the people that are performing on these shows. Most notably, this Saturday, January 23rd, I will be performing improv at the Charlotte Comedy Theater at the NC Music Factory in the back of Wet Willie's. For more information on those shows, make sure you check out charlottecomedytheater.com. Now, on February 9th, which is a Tuesday, I will be performing at the Dead Crow Comedy Club in Wilmington, North Carolina. That's right, I'll be taking a road trip to perform some stand-up comedy. I'll be going with Nick Alexander, who's a former Stranger in a Southern Land guest. We'll be going all the way out to Wilmington on Tuesday, February 9th, at the Dead Crow Comedy Club. And then on Saturday, February 20th, PWX debuts in Gastonia, North Carolina. It's going to be a big event. A lot of big stars are going to be there. I'm sure more information is going to come out about that show. But PWX will be in Gastonia, North Carolina. And more information will be available on that at pwxpro.com. And once again, I got to let you guys know that this podcast is available on the Shining Wizards Podcast Network. So just log on to shiningwizardsnetwork.com and all the available apps that Shining Wizard is available to, much like Audio Boom and Stitcher. So make sure you check out those things, subscribe on there, and follow everybody at Shining Wizards and all the wonderful podcasts that are available on the Shining Wizards Network. Like I said last time, there's a podcast called Neckbreaker, which is about pro wrestling and heavy metal. That sounds like a great podcast. You should be checking that out. Like I said, lots of wonderful and great stuff on the Shining Wizards Network, and make sure you check them out. But also, too, you can check me out, especially on social media. It's very easy to do. All you got to do is just log on Twitter and follow me at ManScoutManning and on Instagram at ManScoutManning. If you have a question about the podcast or if you want to become a sponsor, make sure you email me at jake@sslshow.com. Or if you want to book me for an upcoming wrestling event, make sure you email me at ManScoutManning@yahoo.com. Anyways, let's jump into this wonderful podcast with Dr. Tom Hatchett here on Stranger Southern Land. Yes, folks, I'm sitting here with Dr. Tom Hatchett of the Levine Museum. Dr. Tom, I appreciate you sitting down and talking to me today on Stranger in Southern Land.
It's great. Thank you.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't do a whole heck of a lot of research for these things, and just so I can get to discover things and stuff like that.
That sounds great.
Yeah. So we're just going to discover it as we go, much like history in a sense.
There you go.
Which I've always been a big fan of for quite some time in my life. Like I was telling you off camera, I go to a lot of museums through my travels of pro wrestling, but like very rarely do I get to do anything in town. And I've probably ridden my bicycle past this museum multiple times. So it's very wonderful to sit down and talk to you. And like I said, I've always had a very interest in history, but where did that interest in history start for you in your life?
I'm not a Southerner, and my parents were from the Midwest. We moved into a little mountain town of Troutville, Virginia, because my dad was teaching in that place, and had to figure it out. and people talked different than we did, and they had never heard of our religion. It felt like they'd never heard of our religion. We were Episcopalian. It was a world of the Baptists and Methodists and Church of the Brethren up in Virginia there. And so I became a person who observed and figured out, and part of figuring out where we are is how we got here. And that's what history is.
Yeah. And like you came from like the Chicagoland area, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I was born on the south side of Chicago, though I don't remember it. I was very young at the time.
Yeah.
And then my dad taught at Athens, University of Georgia. And then about my first memories are outside of Roanoke in the Virginia mountains.
Okay. So growing up in Virginia, like, you know, what were the things you were interested in? Like, did you, obviously being curious of like, okay, I'm in a new place. Like what's the lay of the land? You know, it seems like that's always the first thing is getting the lay of the land of the area. You know, like what was it like growing up in Virginia during that time period?
It was still very much country. Today, that area where we grew up is sort of the suburbs of Roanoke, but then it was out in the country. The big deal in town was when the Norfolk and Western coal trains came through. We were on one of the Norfolk and Western main lines, and you could hear it all up and down the valleys. And so I became very aware of railroads. It was the very last days of steam trains, so that was pretty cool. But the other thing was there were still a lot of old houses from earlier days that were kind of moldering away, cabins and things like that. And when we went for drives in the country, my dad would keep us quiet by saying, well, look for lost houses. And it made me really aware of the patterns of farmland and the cabins and the differences over time, because the new ranch style houses were never lost. It was the old wooden ones. And I think very early on got a sense of history and landscape and place.
Yeah, because you'll see a house just like on the side of a road every once in a while that's just abandoned. And I always wonder, like, what's the story there? Like,
yeah.
Obviously, somebody lived there. Obviously, that was somebody's home. And now it says no trespassing. And it's all boarded up and it's falling apart. Like, how did that come to be? You know, like I've always been very fascinated by that as well. Like, there was always an old house in our town that was decaying, and I was like, well, what's the story behind that? Was it haunted? Like, how does a place become like that?
Yeah,
you know, I'm much like yourself. I've always been very intrigued by something like that.
Places have stories, and
yes,
history is not just about presidents. It's not just about wars and battles. It's about the place where you are, and I've been really lucky to figure that out early on and get to play with it all my life, I guess.
Well, was that your initial thing when you were thinking about schooling, was history?
Yeah, when I had a really good seventh grade teacher who built on that. She pointed out that street names often were about where the streets went to back in the olden days, and they still go there, actually. So you could read geography over time in that way. And when I was in high school was when the federal government had money for what they called urban renewal, which meant tearing stuff down. And in our little town in upstate New York, by that point, there was a beautiful Victorian downtown, and the city hadn't grown at all, still hasn't grown since the 1920s. So tearing down a chunk of that Victorian downtown, nothing happened. Nothing was rebuilt. There just was no economic energy. People just didn't understand that. They assumed that because there was stuff there, if you tore it down, new stuff would pop up. And that's not the way the world works. And I wanted to figure out how the world did work and how things got built. And some of those stories that would keep people from tearing down stuff that didn't need to be torn down. So when I was looking at colleges, I looked at architecture, I looked at history. It was a new field that was taught in a couple of places called historic preservation. This is in the 1970s, and ended up at Cornell University, which has an architecture school, really good history department, and one of the first graduate programs in historic preservation. So that's where the college part of all of this happened.
You say, like, you know, historic preservation was like, it makes me think, like, have we never thought, like, to preserve anything historically as American until the 1970s?
Well,
like,
it's the flip side of all of that highway building and urban renewal in the 50s and 60s.
Because it's always started, like, we were just mowing stuff over. We're America, progress. Yeah.
And the generation that went through that, many people just thought it was stupid and hated it and wanted to slow down that engine of change. And I guess I'm part of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it seems like there's even a little bit of that going on, like, today in Charlotte. Like,
yes.
Like, everything is getting mowed over for condos and putting stuff up. And and we're not alone in that as far as cities go. Do you see it very similar in that sense?
Yep. At that point, there was a central effort to do that using federal tax dollars and local tax dollars. And at that point, another change that was created as a response. At that point, you could, if you were the government, you could build stuff, just condemn land and build it. And there wasn't much in the way of public hearings or environmental review or anything like that. And all of that came as a response to that wholesale leveling of neighborhoods and the cutting of highways through old areas. What's going on today is more grassroots. It's individual developers, individual real estate people, saying, hey, this corner would be good for some apartments or something like that. Still disconcerting.
It extremely is. There's a lot of, like, musical venues and a lot of, like, smaller communities that are getting, are now in the shadow of these large condominiums that I don't even know if are completely full.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it always makes me think, you know, we think of, like, we're back to the old spooky house and lost houses. You know, when are we going to see the lost condominium building in Charlotte? You know, how many of those are going to be around?
Yeah.
You know, that's what I always
think. Cool question. I like that.
Yeah. But, you know, you're in college, you're studying historical preservation. You know, what's the job market for something like that out there?
Pretty lousy. I eventually figured out that, well, you know, I work at Levine Museum of the New South as a historian, and there are maybe two or three of us in Charlotte. If you include historic house museums, there may be a dozen of us. It's worse job market than trying to be an NBA basketball star.
Oh.
but I didn't know that at the time.
I didn't realize I was sitting next to the Michael Jordan of historians.
Not at all.
Well, maybe the Del Curry of historians.
There you go. I'm thinking more Muggsy Bogues. Remember him?
Yes, I remember Muggsy.
The little short guy and the Hornets had all that passion early on. People loved him. He's still around. People still love him. But the thing that that got me here was there was this grant to study older neighborhoods. There was some federal preservation money around finally in the 1970s. And Dan Morrill at the Historic Landmarks Commission here and a number of folks who were activists in the in-city neighborhoods got together, got a little tiny grant for 14 months. And I was looking around for a position like that.
It's funny how those federal grants, they always got the little time stamp on them, you know, just for a few minutes.
And 14 months. And fortunately, I can't count past 10. I run out of fingers, so I'm still here. But I didn't know anything about Charlotte. I just knew that it was the longest grant that was available. There was one up in Connecticut that was 10 months. What I knew about Charlotte at that point, Charlotte was not on the map. The sports teams, stuff like that.
This is about 81.
If you were into pro wrestling, you probably knew Charlotte, but most people outside the South weren't. And there was a joke about the CH factor, and I really fell into that. You know, I knew that Charlotte was a gracious old colonial city on the South Carolina coast, where for some reason they'd built the University of Virginia. So it turns out we're not Charlottesville and we're not Charleston. We're this place that thought it didn't have any history. I came here and people said, you need to move to Charleston. You're interested in history. And I said, no, there's history here in Charlotte.
Well, when you came here, what type of town was this?
It was smaller than it is now. It is more than doubled in size, much more than doubled in size in those 35 years. It was a city where if you were into the arts, if you were into anything other than, you know, just being 2.5 kids and a station wagon and meat and potatoes and that kind of thing. It was very hard to find other people. And the folks who were trying to make it a better city kind of all knew each other, which was very neat, actually, in retrospect. But it was a city that kind of scared me because it didn't have any old buildings. Mm-hmm. The places that I had grown up, there was a lot of 19th century architecture because they'd been big places back then, the cities that I knew, and even the small towns. But here, Charlotte had only about 20,000 people in 1900. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't much in the way of old Victorian buildings or whatever. And then in the 20th century, we've had not a lot of money, but money each decade to tear stuff down, rebuild. And we've grown in each decade. And it was a scary place because most of what was here was late 20th century. The old stuff was bungalows, which was a new idea. You know, looking back at the bungalows of the 1920s is a good thing. And as I began to do that, I realized that Charlotte was actually very rich in early 20th century architecture as well as late 20th century.
Hmm. Now, what was the main source of industry? Like you say, those families that were 2.5 kids, but what were those people doing?
Well, Charlotte still in the 70s and 80s was known as a center of the textile industry. The mills right in town mostly were closed, but if you went to Gastonia or Kannapolis or Fort Mill, major international textile operations running there. And so that was, I think, what people thought of. But actually, Charlotte's always been a trading city. Since before the Europeans got here, the native people had a trading path called the Nation's Path. That's why Nation's Ford Road exists. It was where the trading path forded the shallow place in the Catawba River. And that ran right up what's now Tryon Street. Tryon Street's where it is because it follows that old Indian path. There was another pass that crossed it, went down to Charleston. So this has been a trading city from the very beginning. And it was the place where, you know, if you wanted a Buick automobile someplace in North Carolina, you bought it from C.C. Coddington, who was based in Charlotte. He was the wholesaler for Buick, and he also ran the radio station, WBT, which was Watch Buick's Travel. Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
Coca-Cola. You want a Coca-Cola anywhere in the Carolinas, you get it through Charlotte. The largest independent Coca-Cola bottler in the world, I think, is in Charlotte. And so being a wholesale hub, being a place where people sell each other stuff, being a trading city, that really was what Charlotte was at that time. And despite the fact we're also a banking city now and a couple other things, that's still a real basis of who we are today.
Mm-hmm. Well, you just mentioned about like you had interest in the arts. There was a small few people and they all kind of knew each other. Who were those people that, you know, trying to make a move for this to be?
One who was much older than I was Jack Pentis. And Jack Pentis is built some of the first public art in Charlotte. If you go out West Trade Street, there's a sculpture that is wind panels that move when the breeze blows. He just went out and did that. There wasn't a public art program in Charlotte or anything like that. He was an advertising guy, a creative guy. He's best known for inventing ball crawls. You go to McDonald's or the park or whatever, and there are these places you can play that are all balls.
Okay.
And he invented those. It became quite well to do thanks to McDonald's and other fast food places, Burger King. So he was here being creative, and there were people around him doing interesting things. The younger generation, there was a potter named Paul Sayers. Spirit Square had just opened. It was an old Baptist church. And it became a center for people who were interested in the arts, and you could find space there. And Paul Sayers started a clay studio there, and eventually he's the guy that moved out to Noda, which was a decaying mill area, bought a building that was literally falling down. The whole back of it had collapsed, and turned that into the Center of the Earth Gallery, and that's the beginning of the Noda rebirth. So it was really cool being around these people that were we're making Charlotte a much better place to live.
Was that one of the things that sparked NoDa to be like the artist community that it is today?
Yeah. If you go up there, the original building they did still has the sign on it that says the Arts District. And a later real estate person who was important in the neighborhood is the person that coined the NoDa north of Davidson Street, North Davidson Street area, rather. Paul Sires and Ruth Ava Lyons, his wife, who is also an artist, from the beginning of the rebirth in the 80s and 90s, believed it should be the arts district for Charlotte, and it became that.
Well, speaking of the arts and the arts that I dabble in, and that's pro wrestling, and you just mentioned it, you know, there wasn't anything to be interested in other than maybe pro wrestling and maybe NASCAR at the time if you were coming to Charlotte.
Right.
Did you happen to be a fan or get exposed to wrestling at all while you were here?
I didn't get it. I was not raised around that culture. I was raised in a violently nonviolent household. Mm-hmm. And so my mom didn't even like us watching football. And when my brother was very much into basketball, and we always went to see teams that we knew were going to lose because it seemed wonderfully non-competitive and pure and moral and all of that sort of mm-hmm. stuff. So it took me a long time to figure out how cool wrestling was. Mm-hmm. And it took even longer to realize that Charlotte was a real epicenter for that. As the cable TV world came into being, it was folks in Charlotte who said, hey, that would be a way to fill some of the airtime on cable TV. And what had been a very small, very amateur sport suddenly became a big deal. And unfortunately, by the time I figured all of that out, it had been bought up by some people in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And much of the sport is no longer headquartered here. First, I think Ted Turner and other people in Atlanta bought pieces of the world.
It was about 89 would have been the time that it was, you know, under Ted Turner, and then it was more of an Atlanta thing than it was a Charlotte thing. But like, it was a stronghold here for a while. And to me, like I talk to people from that era, but maybe because I'm talking to wrestling fans, it just seems like everybody was interested in it, and like there's little corners in the city about it, like the Jim Crockett Promotions office just off Briar Bend Road, you know, and they'd film some of the promos that aired on, you know, TBS, you know, where they attacked Dusty Rhodes, and it was like, oh, it was just over here, and they pulled out of that toys, you know, toy. And then like, oh, this was the bar where Magnum TA was before he had his accident, and then there was Magnum TA was in the hospital, and they had to shut the phone lines off of the hospital. Like, to me, it was always like, I hear like it was such a big deal in Charlotte, like it was just affected by everybody.
Yeah. You know? Well, it was something that, you know, was blue collar in its initial appeal, but people at every part of the economic and educational spectrum got into it. Like I say, it was one of those things. Big holds in my upbringing. I also didn't get evangelical religion. And I can remember going one time to see Billy Graham because I knew he was important, but he just hadn't been part of my culture. So this thing of having been an outsider still operates. I still got a lot to learn.
You kind of feel like that's the way I feel about this city sometimes. I miss out on what's kind of the cool things that are going on with it. There's been a lot of documentaries about like the wrestling of this city and stuff like that, especially Jim Crockett Promotions, yeah, especially Jim Crockett Sr., who used to bring a lot of the carnivals in. Like, he was the guy, he was just a promoter promoting regular stuff. And then this wrestling thing just exploded out of nowhere. You know, I always find that to be a very fascinating part of this city, because if a couple of things go a different way, it's no longer WWE, it's NWA. And then this is basically the center of the world for wrestling.
Yeah.
You know,
that's happened more than once. And what's true in this, what was true when I came, less true now, was that this is a very class stratified city.
Okay.
And there were things that if you were upper class, you were not supposed to be interested in, and vice versa. And one that I stumbled upon when I was in college, I discovered traditional string band music, mm-hmm. bluegrass, and then the roots of bluegrass. Love that music. And in a college environment in the 70s, that was very cool. Mm-hmm. That was sort of cutting edge, you know, the back to the land, back to nature, acoustic music. Oh, really great stuff. I came to Charlotte and the more educated older people clearly looked down their nose at that. They did not share my enthusiasm, and they weren't mean and nasty about it. They just we weren't plugging in together. And after I'd been here about a year, I discovered that Bill Monroe, the father of bluegrass, had made his first records here. Oh. And by gosh, the Carter family had been here on WBT radio twice. They'd made their last records as the original trio. Uncle Dave Macon. Uncle Dave Macon was one of the touchstones of this string band revival. He'd been in the Grand Ole Opry, and he made his last commercial recordings in Charlotte. And wow. And so we put together something called the Charlotte Country Music Story. We invited as many people back as we could. It was a wonderful weekend and broadcast on WTVI. But because it was at Spirit Square in the center city, for the first time it said, this is everybody's music. This is not just mill people's music. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget the Briar Hoppers, who had been the house band at WBT, still around, still together with some of their original members. Whitey and Hogan, longest running duo in country music history. Whitey talked about this time when one of the mill owners who listened to them on the radio and loved them brought them under cover of darkness to his mansion out in the country. And they did the whole WBT Briar Hopper show with all of the guest stars and everything live for that man and his family. Under cover of darkness, because that was mill people's music. It wasn't mill owners' music. And I got the same feeling with the world of wrestling when I came, that it was something that a lot of people pigeonholed at a particular place in this class stratified city, but it really wasn't. It was really something that anybody could get into.
Yeah. Well, what do you think caused that class stratification in this city?
Well, it's something that happens, it seems like, in every society to a certain point. I really don't know. I've been in some other textile-only cities. Charlotte was never a textile-only city, but in High Point, they talk about there being an elite and then a working class, because there were, you either owned the mills or you worked in the mills. And there was a big divide in terms of opportunity and, you know, what you could do, not just how much money you had in your pocket. And I think some of that was at play in Charlotte as well. It was an industry that, unlike some industries where, you know, you can easily work your way up, or you can start your own, you could spin off and start your own whatever it is, grocery store. Mm-hmm. Hard to do that with a textile mill. I've never been asked that question. I like that. That's great.
Well, and I also think, I don't know, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I almost feel a little bit that exists to an extent.
Oh, yeah.
Because when people talk about Myers Park, it always comes with a roll of the eyes, like, oh, you live in your Myers Park or like South Park. Like, there's certain areas of the city that are very, you know, I'm trying to think of a polite word to use, but in the sense of a very higher class of people, in a sense. And a lot of people roll their eyes to it and stuff like that. And it seems like that exists in this city to an extent. And I don't know if you feel the same way as well, or you've seen that.
I think it exists in every city.
Yeah.
And what's happened here in the last 35 years, as I've been watching, is that so many new people are coming in, but also, you know, young people coming up and becoming old people. Are changing things. And it's a city that's unusually open. It's never had a really entrenched old line family elite where you had to go through those people in order to do something.
Yeah, we don't have like a Rockefeller of Charlotte. Yeah. You know, we don't have, you know, an Edison or, you know, somebody like that.
Yeah.
But it seems like we've got several thousand families that have very nice homes in different parts of the sector. I'm like, oh, this is so-and-so's and so-and-so's. But I always find that, like, neighborhoods in this city are always, they have their own type of personality to them. Like, I live very close to the Plaza Midwood area, and that is fluctuating all of the time right now.
Right.
There's a lot of stuff going on with that. Like, are there any particular neighborhoods in this, the city that strike you as have a lot of history to them or unique history?
Oh, I think every city and neighborhood has history. And it doesn't have to be old to be history.
Yeah.
How you got here is history. So that's one answer. But I do love our early 20th century neighborhoods, the Fourth Ward Historic District down behind Discovery Place with the Victorian buildings, Dilworth, which was the first streetcar suburb when that new technology came online, Edward Dilworth Latta, who owned 400 acres of farmland outside the city, nothing you could do with it, hired Thomas Edison, and they electrified the streetcar system, and suddenly you could sell lots way out of town in Dilworth, and people could commute. Imagine that, going back and forth each day on the trolley. Plaza Midwood, Elizabeth, the Nodi area, Myers Park, Wesley Heights and Wilmore over on the west side. All of those are neighborhoods that were built up in the era of bungalow architecture, and they're neighborhoods with big old trees and sidewalks and houses that have kind of settled into the landscape. And when I came to Charlotte, that era of 20th century design was not appreciated. It wasn't just Charlotte, it was the nation as a whole. And I'm so glad that those neighborhoods are still here, because they were melting away. There used to be big old houses on Elizabeth Avenue near Presbyterian Hospital. Mm-hmm. There may be two of them left. And a lot of those have disappeared since I've been here. So the fact that there are old neighborhoods is not something we can take for granted. It's something you got to work at.
Yeah, absolutely. I've heard a lot of history about the Greer Heights like area. And I think you were just mentioning off camera that you were working on something as far as the history of that neighborhood. Can you just kind of speak to that?
The area that I'm working on is McCrory Heights, both of those are African-American neighborhoods. McCrory Heights is near Johnson C. Smith University. It was built after World War II at a time when black people still could not live in neighborhoods like Cotswold. And so H.L. McCrory, who was the president of Johnson C. Smith, by gosh, built his own neighborhood. Ranch houses, a lot of doctors, lawyers, very impressive people built there in the 1950s and 60s. Greer Heights has a very different history. Greer Heights is over on the east side of town, sort of between Randolph Road and Monroe Road. Very large African-American neighborhood that was developed back when that was countryside. The Greer family household was very near where Loopy's restaurant is, if you find that on Monroe Road. There was also the Billings family on the other end of what became the neighborhood, and they gave land for the Billingsville School, which was a rural school. The original building is still back there behind the new Billingsville School. And so that was a neighborhood out in the country that was African-American. And then as it came into the city, it filled out with homeowners and rental housing. And because it has a lot of renters and a lot of absentee landlords, there's been issues with how to keep that neighborhood a good place to live. Hard to do that when you don't have a lot of homegrown capital in a neighborhood. And it's really interesting to watch that old Billingsville school from the 1920s become a rallying point for the neighborhood. So I'm hearing good things about Greer Heights this day.
Yeah, there's every time, because I work over by that area, I see different things happening. And I've noticed a lot, too, recently, some of the rougher areas, they put police stations right next to them, almost in a sense of, like, we're here.
You know
what I'm saying? Being a part of the community as opposed to being down the street and we only come over here when there's bad things going on. But no, we're here all the time. I think that's something that the city's police department has consciously done. It's something I've consciously noticed.
Yeah.
I would imagine it's intentional.
Yeah. Rodney Monroe, that was one of the things he especially wanted to do, was to make police visible and make them part of neighborhoods the way fire stations are. Mm-hmm. And so the first one was on Beatty's Ford Road, right near McCrory Heights, right next to near Northwest School of the Arts. And very popular among police and among folks in the neighborhood. And now they're starting to pop up everywhere. There's one in my neighborhood on Central Avenue, just past Plaza Midwood. It's a way of learning from the past, because that notion of having a police station up on the street and part of the neighborhood has roots in the fire station history.
But you're talking about, like, you know, the Greer Heights, and I was like a rural community, and I remember seeing old pictures of the Coliseum, the old Coliseum, and that being like out in the country almost, in the right. sense, the way they used to with the Coliseum after that, where they put it outside of town, because I think that was like a big nationwide thing where we put our big Coliseum outside of town so it wouldn't create all this traffic. And then nationally, it seemed like, no, you put your big arena downtown.
Right.
And I think Charlotte kind of got caught between those two transitions.
Right.
But like the old Charlotte Coliseum.
Yeah, the Big Biscuit.
Yes.
The Bojangles.
Yes.
Coliseum, which was, I think, the largest concrete dome in the world. It was an architectural landmark.
It stood the test of time. I was going to say, there's got to have some history to that.
Yeah. And done by A.G. Odell, who was a major modernist architect based in Charlotte, who had a national reputation. And indeed, Independence Boulevard went out through the farmers' fields at that point, and the neighborhoods grew up around the Coliseum rather than vice versa.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, like what type of, like, when you were here, like in the early 80s, what type of stuff was coming through? Because I mean, Charlotte was obviously a smaller city,
right?
So, like, you know, it kind of interests me what type of like musical acts or attractions would come through there.
We felt aggrieved because a lot of national acts didn't stop in Charlotte.
Yeah, because it's just
They would stop in Atlanta, they would head up the highway, they would stop in DC, they wouldn't stop here. The Blumenthal Theater Complex had not yet happened, and so it was really hard to see the touring, what are now an industry of touring Broadway shows. And because of that, people made their own entertainment. So you had the monster truck rallies, and you had the professional wrestling, but also rock and roll, rhythm and blues, a lot of homegrown impressive music here. I did not have a car early on, so I went places I could bicycle. And I do remember getting out to the Coliseum to see B.B. King.
Really?
And it was an awful concert, because being inside a dome when they have the amplifiers turned up is not what you want to do.
Yeah.
I unfortunately missed the Eric Clapton concert at the Coliseum, where afterwards he came to the Double Door Inn and sat in with the Pine Top Perkins band. Pine Top Perkins had been a sideman with Muddy Waters.
Oh, wow.
But I did love the Double Door. It was an old bungalow on Independence Boulevard, still there. Mm-hmm. House beat to pieces, put back together, and turned into this wonderful blues club that's been around since the 1970s. I think it's something like the second longest running blues club in the United States at this point.
And that's just the one that's just off of 7th here, right?
Right.
7th on Charlottetown? Or
Charlotte. Yeah, what's now Charlottetown was originally Independence Boulevard.
Okay. Yeah, so I go by it all the time. It's just over by the streetcar rail and stuff like that. But it seems like there's little, like, you know, you get those smaller touring acts that would come through, like even like I always think about the Milestone. They always talk
right.
about the history there. You know, they talk about Nirvana went there, like Stooges or a lot of the punk bands, you know, that I always forget the names of and stuff like that. It seems like those smaller acts would always make their way through Charlotte, because we never got to see some of the bigger acts. But also, too, eventually this city got professional sports teams. When did it get to a point that we were going to see a professional sports team in this city? Because we always had minor league baseball for quite some time.
Yeah, Crockett Park, same family that did the wrestling promotions. There was a feeling that basketball was going to be it, and it turned out it was. When I came to town, I'd never heard of ACC basketball. I'm not a sports person. I'm I apologize, but I'm not. And I came, and I can remember going for a walk on the day that I think NC State played Chapel Hill for the ACC championship sometime in the 80s, something like that happened. I apologize if I got it wrong. But
well, I don't know what
it was like Christmas morning. There were no cars on the street. People were all watching their televisions. And so clearly basketball was a big deal. And in the 80s, the NBA was expanding, and Charlotte leaders got together and brought the Hornets here. And boy, that was a big deal. And the Hornets, which today are beginning to find fan approval again after going through so many different changes, but they sold out the first year, and they sold out the second year, and they sold out year after year, despite the fact that the team didn't win. Because people were just so basketball hungry. And they were national attention hungry, because that was a moment where the United States started to watch us, where you know, people in Charlotte were on the Wheaties box in the grocery store. It was a big deal.
Yeah, it seems like it, because it always seems like, you know, I've heard the joke, you know, we're like a second city to an Atlanta in a sense. Like, we always had that feeling of, you know, we're not as good as, or you know, not as big.
Yeah, there was a hope in the 80s that we would become Atlanta. And today there is a hope we will not become Atlanta, because Atlanta has made some bad choices in terms of traffic and in terms of not centralizing things in a center city that everybody can get to. Atlanta's really hard to deal with if
yes,
you spend much time there. I spent a year there. It was a very long year. And so that's a big change in Charlotte. We've gone from wanting to be Atlanta to wanting to be Charlotte, and we're getting pretty good at being Charlotte.
Yeah, I'd agree. And especially now they consider this like a banking capital. You know, we had Wachovia here. We had, we now have Bank of America, and of course Wells Fargo and stuff like that. When did that type of, you know, merger with the city and banking happen? Like, how did that come
about? It's always been here, but it was quiet. I didn't get it when I was here in the 80s, and I missed some big turning points. Here at Levine Museum in the New South, we have a section on that rise of interstate banking. Don't go to sleep. I said interstate banking, don't go to sleep. It's actually interesting.
No, I actually scooted up in my chair.
There you go.
I'm paying attention. That,
you're good.
Forget everybody else. I am.
But it's the kind of thing that really does, you know, you go, oh, I'm not interested in that. Yes, you are.
Yeah.
1982, before 82, there were laws that said, because we had all these depressions, people had gotten into trouble, that banks really needed to only deal with their own community. And you could not legally run a bank so far from where you were. Different places, different states, there were all state laws. But here, because we have this far-flung textile industry with lots of places that need capital and need loans and need support for their businesses, North Carolina was an unusual state in that a bank in any city could run a branch in any other city. And so banks here, Wachovia in Winston-Salem originally, First Union and NCNB in Charlotte, got really good at competing, got really good at running branch systems. We have one of the very first computer-linked ATMs. They were developed by IBM in Charlotte for First Union. Revolution, because at that point, you could run a branch system anywhere. Computer lines, satellites, and dang. And in 1982, Hugh McCall with NCNB put together a sort of SWAT team and lawyers and bankers and said, find me a bank I can legally buy someplace out of state. And they found a bank in Lake City, Florida. They bought it. And it was the beginning of the change in all of those laws, because as soon as one person figured out how to do it, other people are going to figure out how to do it. By the end of the 80s, we were one of the major banking cities in the United States. McCall bought Bank of America out of San Francisco, moved the headquarters here, and bam, we were the second biggest banking center in the United States. And that's because McCall and Ed Crutchfield at First Union and the folks around them were thinking outside of the box. They were not the big dogs, and so they had to work harder. And that's really been a story in Charlotte from the very beginning.
Yeah, and would you say that's what's caused a lot of the growth as far as population goes?
It sure hasn't hurt. Mm-hmm. Being a big banking center is a big deal. But we've always been really diversified. Mm-hmm. We have at Levine Museum of the New South a couple of panels looking at Fortune 500 companies. In the 1970s, there were two. They were both textiles, Cannon Mills and Springmade Sheet Company. Today, no textile firms. We have something like 8 Fortune 500 companies. Lowe's Home Improvement grew up in this area. Family Dollar grew up in this area. Harris Teeter grew up in this area. Some of them get bought by out of town. And so that's not a current list. But by the 19-teens, this was a very diverse city. The 2010s, rather, not the 1910s. One of our big companies is a bank, but the other 8 or 9 or however many it is on the Fortune 500 company list at the moment are all sorts of other things. So banking is real important, but it goes back to that being a trading city, being a wholesaling city, being a city of salesmen. That's our DNA as much as banking is.
Like I said, I always think every time I see somebody new come, oh, you just came in for the banks and stuff like that. But I do forget a lot of times that Family Dollar and a lot of the other big corporations have their
and just sort of miscellaneous jobs. We put together an exhibit here called Changing Places about all of the newcomers coming to Charlotte. And in Pittsburgh, there was a week-long series about that time of people who packed up the car from Pittsburgh and said, I'm tired of the cold, I'm tired of the unemployment, and I want to go someplace better. And the whole series was about people that left Pittsburgh for Charlotte. Hmm. And I don't know that any of them came because they had a job at a bank. I think they just came because they heard it was a growth place, and it was a good place.
Yeah, and then, like I said, there's thousands of transplants. We were just, somebody was just walking through here and they said that they originally grew up in Charlotte, and like you were shocked that you met somebody like that. And that's what it feels like in this city a lot of times.
Yeah.
Because you always ask, like, where are you from? And it's usually Ohio, Indiana. Right. A lot of Midwesterners come from here, but then even to a lot of Northerners as well.
Look at Interstate 77 on Friday night, count the Ohio plates going north.
Yeah, there's a lot of them. And then, of course, if you go in the little areas where I am at, there's always the Ohio State flag waving outside, or an Indiana flag, in support of the Hoosiers and stuff like that. Right. And I always think that's, as far as the football team for the city, that's always weird for them too, because they come from someplace else where they've been fans of something else, and now we have a football team that's doing very well.
Yeah.
And everybody is like, oh, everybody's jumping on the bandwagon. Well, of course, because nobody's really been in Charlotte until now.
Yeah, that's really true.
Just the fact that we have an NFL team, and especially that it's doing so well, I think that always does well with, putting more attention to Charlotte in a positive light.
Yeah.
But when did it, we talked about when it get to a point with the basketball. We knew the basketball was going to be a thing, and we finally got a team. But as far as football, I always feel like that puts you in another echelon of cities.
Right.
It seems like to me, do you see it that way too? And do you see it?
Not being a sports person, I'm not a really good judge. I do know that thanks to Cam Newton and the whole Panther team, Ron Rivera is featured in one of our exhibitions here called Nuevo Lucian, Latinos in the New South, mm-hmm. talking about trying to build a family feeling within the football team, because that's what he grew up in his Latino household. I think he's really managed to instill that in this team. I don't know whether they're going to go to the Super Bowl or not. By the time you see this, you may know the answer.
We'll probably
to that.
Know that answer.
It's been one heck of a ride, and there's a feeling of warmth, I think, within the team from Ron Rivera on one hand and Cam Newton on the other hand, that suffuses the team, but also reaches out and makes Charlotte feel good and welcoming and embracing of this sports team. I've been telling you, I'm not a sports person. We got one of those antennas so we can watch local television again, specifically to watch the Panthers. Yes.
Well, and not to diminish the Fortune 500 companies that are here that have made Charlotte a very important place. I'm not saying that the NFL team was the sole reason that, oh, well, now we're a big city because of the NFL team. But at the same time, too, I do feel a sense of that. It's a big part of, like I said, we were talking about people that from Ohio and Indiana, right. Midwest, Northerners and stuff like that. You know, sports is, you know, something that brings people together a lot. And, right. and I feel like, especially when a team wins and everybody pulls together, like, no, I live in Charlotte. I'm now a Panthers fan. I'm not a Pittsburgh fan. I'm not a Bengals fan.
Yeah.
I'm not a, you know, Dolphins fan or Atlanta Hawks or Atlanta Falcons fan. No, I'm a Panther fan. Yeah. You know?
Well, I think in Charlotte, on my happy days, I think we are becoming a city of both and. It used to be that you were either black or white, that you were either rich or poor, mm-hmm. that you lived on this side of town and didn't deal with the people on that side of town, that you eat this kind of food and not that kind of food. And now there are still black people and white people, but there's a lot of other and there still is wealth and poverty, but there's a lot of in the middle, and there is a lot of willingness to we see this in the Nueva Lucien exhibit looking at Latinos in the New South. For people to embrace the new culture that they're in the middle of, but hang on to their pupusas or tacos or pozole or whatever, you know, the foods were that they knew back home, but also reach out and maybe even try a liver mush sandwich, mm-hmm. or a bowl of Vietnamese pho soup. And so it's an exciting time to be in this big city. It is a city that has a strong history of trade and textiles and all of that, but it's also a city of newcomers. It's a city that since the New South era, we talk about the New South era as an area that began after the Civil War when the South had to reinvent itself. Boy, are we still reinventing.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And like, you know, when you see, have these people that show up here for whatever job,
right.
You know, whether it's working in the banking industry or you know, or the other jobs of the Fortune 500 companies or the other jobs that are available, you know, you come here as a stranger in a sense, much like I came
yes.
here and much
yes.
like, you know, the kind of the project of this podcast, you know, being a stranger in a southern land. It's
yeah.
you're in a very distinctly southern place, you know, and because of the food, because of the culture, you know, NASCAR and everything else and climate and everything like that. But
yeah.
but there's a lot of people walking around as a stranger. It's like they're coming here specifically for a job and they may not have any friends whatsoever here. So I always feel like this city is a bunch of people just bumping around trying to find something
right.
new. And almost that's part of the history is there's thousands upon thousands of people trying
right.
to do that. And it's, right. it's a very exciting time. Because it's like once we all come together on something, you know, we'll make our own history as a city.
Right.
You know,
well, a good place to start if you want to plug in is Levine Museum of the New South to give a plug for Levine
oh, yeah.
Museum. We have a regular program 4 or 5 times a year called the New South for the New Southerner. Humpy Wheeler, who was one of the guys that built NASCAR, was our guest last time. We're going to be talking about art controversies at the next one in March. And then we're going to have a beer tasting with folks who are building the brewery industry here in Charlotte. That'll be in May. At Levine Museum in the New South, what we talk about is using history to build community. Mm-hmm. If people know the stories of how the city got to be, plus the stories of people who are coming here and bringing their own history, like the Latino folks or like me, if we know each other's history, then we're not strangers.
Absolutely. Well, that's a beautiful place to leave it. And before we get off, like you were talking about the Levine Museum, where are the places they can look for it? Like website address and everything?
www.museumofthenewsouth.org. Museumofthenewsouth.org. Just come down and see us. We're on 7th Street at the corner of College Street. There's a deck next door that has an amazing food court called the Public Market. Park in that deck, bring us your white card. We'll validate you for 2 hours, which is a pretty good deal in the center city. The museum is free the first Sunday of each month. So mark that on your calendar as a way to dip your toe into what we have. And we're also a place where you can connect into other history agencies and organizations around the city.
All right. Well, Tom, before we get off, if there's anything I've glazed over, anything you want to bring out to light on this podcast?
This is great. Thank you so much.
No, thank you so much, Tom. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
This has been a DSCT.TV production.